Hello, everyone, and welcome to our fourth podcast on the intertestamental period. Over our six lessons, we are discussing three categories that shaped Jewish belief during the period up to the time of Jesus. The first two podcasts focused on the political changes and the new ways of understanding Yahweh's reign over the Jewish people and the world. We're currently in section two, podcast three and four, which take a look at the cultural impulse of Hellenism and how it affected Jewish identity. Then we'll wrap up in podcasts 5 and 6 with religious beliefs that developed during the period, as well as different groups within Judaism that sprang up. And of course, all of these were relating back to the New Testament specifically. How did these changes in the intertestamental period affect what's going on in the New Testament? Let's do a quick review of last week and what we talked about. So last week, we took a look at the rise of the culture of Hellenism. What was Hellenism? What defined it? What made it so new and so challenging to Jewish identity? We also looked at the reactions to Hellenism from intertestamental Judaism. We looked at the new types of literature that sprang up. We talked about apocalyptic and how that was something very unique, created as political literature. We also talked about the Mishnah, creating an understanding of how to live out the Torah in a Gentile context, as well as testaments and oracles. We also looked at the multiple groups that formed during the intertestamental period. We looked and saw that you have a wide range of different types of groups. Some on the far side that said we're going to completely become separate and we're ascetic in nature. And then on the opposite side, groups that said we're going to become Hellenists. We're going to forego our Jewish identity and lose that by becoming Greek. Our focus for today is going to be on the markers for being in God's covenant people. And then we'll also talk about the effects on the New Testament specifically. So as we said before, the confrontation with other cultural perspectives and ideas forced intertestamental Judaism to further define Jewish identity. So, what are those markers? What tells another Jewish person, hey, I'm part of the covenant people of God? Well, in order to do that, we need to talk about praxis in Hellenistic Judaism. How did they actually go about practicing their Jewish faith? First of all, we must say that it was known and accepted that certain practices separated Jews from Gentiles. Everyone knew that. Everyone accepted that. Even the Romans knew that's the way it was. And we know that because it was commented on by both Jewish and Gentile writers. They were talking back and forth, so to speak, and they talk about this. As God's covenant people, Hellenistic Jews saw themselves as being called to be different and to separate from the Gentile nations. And so they picked up practices that are either found directly in Torah, such as circumcision, or are interpretations of Torah, such as the idea of marriage within the Jewish community. So what we see is Torah is here being elevated in importance during this period. And these practices were a major focus of Hellenistic Judaism. You have to know Torah and how to interpret it so that you can ensure that you are faithfully identifying with the covenant people. At the same time, we don't want to misconstrue what drives their perspective. They wanted to fulfill Yahweh's commands because they are God's people, not because they are trying to become God's people. So they're not fulfilling Torah in some sort of pelagic idea that they're going to earn their salvation by following these practices. That would be outside of what they believed. Oftentimes, though, unfortunately, we have that misconception because it was put forth by the Protestant reformers of the 16th century, Luther and all those folks. What Luther did was he applied to Judaism his perspective on the Roman Catholic Church, which he also saw as being a salvation based on works. Now, this perspective largely went unchallenged because it really confirmed the racial presuppositions of Christian theologians over many centuries. And honestly, it wasn't until the late 20th century when Christian theologians started to read the literature of the intertestamental period and discovered the motivation was the desire to be good covenant partners with God rather than to earn their way to salvation. So covenant is the fundamental basis for faith in Jewish Hellenistic Judaism in the intertestamental period. And I've given us here a reading from the first century BCE Psalms of Solomon. And it reflects this focus on the covenant. It reads, "And now you are our God, and we are the people whom you have loved. Look and be compassionate, O God of Israel, for we are yours. And do not take away from your mercy, do not take away your mercy from us, lest they set upon us." They being, of course, Gentiles and non-believers. "For you chose the descendants of Abraham above all the nations, and you put your name upon us, Lord, and it will not cease forever. You made a covenant with our ancestors concerning us, and we hope in you when we turn our souls to you. May the mercy of the Lord be upon the house of Israel forever." Not too much of a legalistic perspective there on the relationship between Israel and Yahweh. So what were some of these markers? Some of these things that said, "I am Jewish," during the intertestamental period? Well, definitely circumcision was one of them. Of course, circumcision was implemented by Abraham. We see it in Genesis 17. It was a sign of the covenant between Abraham's descendants and Yahweh. It was done the eighth day after a child's birth. And in order to join Abraham and his group, other nations would have to become circumcised. So we see in Genesis 34, Shechem, the Shechemites, they have to become circumcised in order to marry into the larger clan. Also, we saw that with the Idumeans, if we remember back to our history of the first two podcasts, the Idumeans had to become circumcised when they were conquered by the Maccabees. So I guess the question is, well, why is this a defining feature? Why circumcision? Well, in their viewpoint, to not circumcise is to reject your standing in the sphere of the covenant and not identify with the covenant people. It becomes a unique religious identity through this rite of circumcision. And you actually see it becoming a metaphor. We see passages in the Psalms where it talks about the heart, the lips, the ears being circumcised to God, wanting to honor God with those. In the first century, we also see references to it in different groups. The Qumran community said that being circumcised is a way of entering the community and resembles Abraham's circumcision in that it removes what they call the spirit of enmity. So again, there's something special about it. In the book of Jubilees, which comes from the 2nd century BCE, we have a passage that talks about it, and it says, "And all the sons of Belial will leave their sons without circumcision just as they were born. And great wrath from the Lord will be upon the sons of Israel because they have left his covenant and have turned aside from his words. And they have provoked and blasphemed inasmuch as they have not done the ordinance of this law, because they have made themselves like the Gentiles to be removed and be uprooted from the land. And there is therefore from them no forgiveness or pardon, so that they might be pardoned and forgiven from all of their sins of this eternal error." Well, that's a pretty harsh take on not circumcising your children. So what did circumcision look like in daily life in the first century? Well, it was first of all pretty apparent who was Jewish and who was not, especially when you go to the Greek gymnasium where you do athletics in the nude, or to the public baths, which were, as you might imagine, in the nude, for women and for men, by the way. So you couldn't necessarily hide it if you had been circumcised. The Romans actually would use circumcision against the Jews. They had put a poll tax on Jews. They had to pay a certain amount to the government. So if a person said, "I'm not Jewish," all they would do is bring him in and then pull his robe off of him to say, "Well, you're circumcised, so guess what? You're going to pay the tax." Of course, if you're a slave, you don't necessarily get to choose to do circumcision. That decision is made by your master. So you could be a Jewish slave, at least ethnically, I guess, who was not circumcised. That's just sort of the way it was. Well, what were Gentiles' views on circumcision? Well, you know, circumcision as a practice wasn't actually unique to Judaism, even though it became a defining feature. But the Greek culture did not look favorably upon it. They saw exposing the tip of the penis as indecent and repugnant. Men would actually have surgery to correct if they had a short foreskin, and some men would use a pin or a string, you know, to tie it in place. So some Jews kind of tried to compromise. Maybe they'd only cut off a little. They tried to have a surgery to fix it so that it wasn't as noticeable, things of that nature. Realize, of course, as we said, having a Greek education and bearing was the way of citizenship. And that was, being a citizen was a very good thing back in then. So being circumcised sort of hampered that goal, if you will, for some folks. So there was what we honestly can say was strong cultural pressure to not continue this practice. And we see lots of condemnation from Gentile writers, Martial, Celsus, and others. And obviously, this was one of the major issues for Paul and the early church. You know, in Galatians 5, of course, in Acts 15, Ephesians 2, and Romans 3, we see all these passages deal with circumcision. So circumcision was one of the major issues that they faced. What were some of the other markers for Jewish identity? Well, another strong one was dietary laws. Of course, these dietary laws, the kosher food laws, were established in the Torah. You see a few items in Genesis. You know, you can't eat a limb cut from a live animal. Exodus has a few items. obviously you have the Passover meal being instituted. And then in Leviticus 11, you have really a biblical taxonomy of animals and what can and can't be eaten, as well as certain types of beverages and things like that. So now, of course, what you see in Leviticus isn't necessarily all-inclusive. As they ran into different types of animals in the larger world that aren't mentioned in Leviticus, they had to make decisions about, okay, can we eat this? Can we not eat this? That sort of thing. So why was this a defining feature? Well, certain types of foods and mixtures of foods had significance with other religious rites, you know, fertility rites, etc. So by acceding to these dietary laws, you're really seeing a way to focus on sanctification, a way to depaganize your life. So there was widespread mixture of food with religious ritual in the intertestamental period, in the culture. And just about any food could be used for religious purposes. So by following these kosher laws, you're making sure that people did not identify you with those rituals. So again, it's a way for you to be separate and identify your calling as a Hellenistic Jew. From the Gentiles' perspective, you know, many cultures had taboos on eating certain types of foods, usually meats or something like that. And the Jews were widely ridiculed by Gentile writers. The Roman writer Juvenal states that he thought the Jews had a special reverence for the pig because they would not eat it. But probably on a much more significant level, Jews were seen as being misanthropic for their refusal to share table food with Gentiles and other ethnic groups. Just imagine the social blowback you would get if you went to someone's house to eat and they put food in front of you, and instead of enjoying it and enjoying the time with your host, you started asking questions about it. Where did you get this food? Has it been sacrificed to idols? Was it from a certain market? Was it killed in a certain way? Those were areas which caused a lot of consternation and worry among the different groups. So that being said, the derision in the larger Gentile world seems to point to the fact that it was generally practiced by Jews. I mean, we see the literature that it talks about establishing kosher markets and things of that nature. So Josephus talks about in the Jewish antiquities some of these special arrangements being made for building probably a synagogue and bringing in kosher food in one of his books. He says about Rome, now the Senate and the people had decreed to permit them, the Jews, to assemble together on the days formally appointed and to act according to their own laws, and that such a place be set apart for them by the praetors for the building and inhabiting the same, as they shall esteem for that purpose. And those that take care of the provision for the city shall take care that such sorts of food as they esteem fit for their eating may be imported into the city. So they specifically were to set up ways for Hellenistic Jews in Rome to get their food in a way that meets with their dietary law expectations. Another way that they identified in the Hellenistic period was through festivals. Now, there are many different festivals that are talked about. We talked already about Hanukkah, how that came about during the Maccabean Revolt and thereafter. We also have the Passover, Pentecost, Tabernacles. You see these in the New Testament. And then also Sabbath, which I know a lot of folks might not say, oh, well, that's Sabbath is just Sunday. How is that a festival? Well, Sabbath is a weekly festival that was held just like the other festivals. It had certain ritual requirements. And so it was, of course, because it was weekly, very well known among everyone. So why is it a defining feature in this period? Well, first of all, it is a symbol of national / religious identity. It recalls part of their story from the exile and things of that nature. You know, a lot of these festivals, we can kind of anachronistically call them patriotic. For example, Passover swelled to 3 to 5 times the normal amount of people. People specifically were supposed to keep a certain amount of money and go spend it in Jerusalem every year. So that's kind of the background of the Passover meal that Jesus gives in the upper room. People would go rent rooms and food and things like that because that's what the law told them to do. So during these times when you have so many people in Jerusalem, the Gentile rulers were always on high alert. And we hear of, in the writing, multiple incidents of pilgrims being killed during festivals due to unrest. So when Jesus walks into the temple before Passover and performs actions that demonstrate his belief that the temple will be destroyed, I mean, how do you think that's going to go over with the people who wanted to keep peace with the Romans, the priestly aristocracy? I mean, of course they'd want to get rid of him, right? Because they've seen this played out before during the Passover. So Sabbath, turning back again to it, was the most important festival practiced by Jews in the larger Hellenistic world. It was the most noticeable because it was weekly, and their multiple questions of propriety. How do you practice Sabbath if you're in the army? Do you tell your commander, I'm not going to go fight today or march because it's Sabbath? How about if you're a farmer and you're in the midst of harvest? Do you not go out and work your fields? If you're someone in the market, do you shut down your stall and not sell? You know, so what you're really doing is asking the ruling authorities to kind of give you a pass on the normal cultural activities. And that, of course, was controversial. How did the Gentiles feel about Sabbath? Well, they had a lot of resentment about it. They, of course, called the Jews lazy. They did not like that it interrupted normal business and social and government events. Of course, wars as well. That was a little bit of a hindrance. You know, they really saw it as a way that separated the Jews from other groups. And because of that, they saw it as a very bad thing. But what we see happening over the course of the first century into the second century is that Romans eventually began to follow this sort of weekly calendar due to the introduction of the astrological calendar. So Saturn's day was seen as unlucky, and so Saturn's day kind of merged with the Sabbath. Of course, we know Saturn's day as being Saturday, which is the day of the Sabbath. So eventually they kind of came to the same calendar and stopped doing a lot of activities as well on the same day. And we talked a little bit about war. We have a passage from 1 Maccabees where the rebels are shown as being so faithful to Torah that they would refuse to fight on the Sabbath. And so 1 Maccabees tells us this, And it was reported to the king's officers and to the troops in Jerusalem, the city of David, that those who had rejected the king's command had gone down to the hiding places in the wilderness. Many pursued them and overtook them. They encamped opposite them and prepared for battle against them on the Sabbath day. They said to them, "Enough of this. Come out and do what the king commands, and you will live." But they said, "We will not come out, nor will we do what the king commands, and so profane the Sabbath day." Then the enemy quickly attacked them, but they did not answer them or hurl a stone against them or block up their hiding places. They were in caves, so. For they said, "Let us all die in our innocence. Heaven and earth testify for us that you are killing us unjustly." So they attacked them on the Sabbath, and they died, with their wives and children and livestock, to a number of 1,000 persons. Now, interestingly enough, the response of the leadership of the revolt, Mattathias and Judas and the other groups, is, okay, maybe that's not the best strategy. So from here on, we will fight on the Sabbath, but only if they attack us. So they kind of found a midway point, if you will, to keep identifying with the requirements of Torah, but at the same time not lose their life. Another marker for Jewish identity was monotheism and the temple. As we've talked about previously, Hellenists were fine with worshiping many local gods because worship meant something very different for the Roman and Greek world than it did for Hellenistic Judaism. So we, as I talked about, have redefined what religion is because of Christianity. Today, we expect a religion to have scriptures or important writings, that it identifies a single ethical path or group of beliefs. And these were not what religion in the ancient wider world was about. Religious ritual was something that you did at certain times. You could worship and pay homage to multiple gods because you were not just focusing on one appropriate action or one overarching belief system. So there was sort of this divorce between religion and ethics. And like I said, we see that in Paul's comments to the Corinthian church. You can't worship Jesus and then go out and hang out with prostitutes, basically. So there was a uniqueness to Judaism and later Christianity in that its idea of having the scripture, the Torah, or the New Testament for Christianity, fidelity to a single God, that it would reorient your whole way of life. Judaism was really seen as a different ethnic, a change in ethnos. When you become Jewish, you are leaving your ethnos for a new one and identifying with a new people. Christianity, on the other hand, did not specify a new ethnos. And that's one of the reasons that it was considered so dangerous to the Romans. It was open to all, and so we'll talk a little bit more in depth about that later. And of course, there was as a part of Judaism, a universal rejection of ideals, figurines, etc., all of which were in Roman households. If you went into a first century Roman household, they would have a niche where the house gods would sit. They would worship there in the house. So we see this perspective in a passage from the Wisdom of Solomon, which is from the first century BCE. It says, "For all people who were ignorant of God were foolish by nature, and they were unable from the good things that are seen to know the one who exists, nor did they recognize the artisan while paying heed to his works. But they supposed that either fire or wind or swift air, or the circle of the stars, or turbulent water, or the luminaries of heaven were the gods that rule the world. If through delight in the beauty of these things people assume them to be gods, let them know how much better than these is the Lord, for the author of beauty created them. And I just think that is a wonderful way to express who God is, the author of beauty. Now, for the temple itself, the temple was a physical symbol for Hellenistic Judaism. In fact, you could say, really, it was the most important symbol of Jewish national / ethnic identity. I don't think I can overstate that fact, because it was the center of the universe. Mount Zion is a cosmic mountain where heaven and earth meet. And so the temple was the symbol of the presence of the covenant with them, their special relationship with God. And we do see different views on whether God inhabited the house. If you look at the prophets, they say no. Other groups, like the Essenes, say no. We see other pieces of literature from the period that say we're looking for God to come back, for the Shekinah glory to come back in, because they, of course, saw themselves as being in the exile. And so since they were in the exile, God was not dwelling among them. For others, though, it seems that they did believe God was there in the temple, living in the temple in some way. The fact that you had cultic activity of sacrifice throughout this period being widely accepted by the populace shows that, yes, there some people did believe, probably on a wide basis, that God was still there at the temple. Because if God is not there at the temple, you don't do all of the sacrifices and functions as a way to gain access to Yahweh. Why go sacrifice if it's just meaningless? We see in the Gospel of Matthew that there's a big focus on the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple as proof for Jesus' claims of messiahship. And of course, in Matthew, we have the ripping of the temple curtain as the final signal of the elimination of the cultic significance of the temple. And that's an argument really you couldn't make for the writer of Matthew if you didn't believe that the temple was significant in some way among the wider population. So the temple really becomes, in the intertestamental period, the focus of intense Jewish nationalism, especially in the Maccabean period. I mean, we remember from a few weeks ago the story of the cleansing of the temple, how it was a national symbol of independence and religious freedom. And of course, the cleansing of the temple by Judas institutes a new festival that is not found in the Old Testament, the festival of Hanukkah, which is so significant that it's carried out today. Herod, of course, rebuilds the temple into this huge, huge edifice because he knows what a powerful symbol it is. Now, of course, Herod's, his ability to use that symbol to convince people he's on their side was somewhat limited. And I'm not sure that it really ever got to the point where people understood that. And of course, the rebuilding of the temple went on long, long after Herod had died. He dies in 4 BCE, and the temple itself is not finished until about 64 CE. So, this also plays into a fact of why other temples were built, as we talked about. It's a symbol of Jewish identity, an attempt to harness this sort of national, religious, social power for the use of those communities. And violating the temple was the ultimate Jewish red line for revolt. So when the Syrian Roman governor Flaccus ignored Caligula's order to place the emperor statue in the temple, he did that because he knew if we do this, it's not going to be a good thing. So, and as I said, when Jesus goes to the temple and enacts the destruction of it, the priestly aristocrats immediately find a way to crucify him. There was no way they were going to let him challenge the major symbol of Jewish identity. So what were some of the reactions to the temple and monotheism? Well, for the temple itself, the Romans really kept strict control over aspects of Jewish worship at the temple. Believe it or not, the high priest had a special chest plate that he would wear to go into the Holy of Holies on the Day of Atonement. It had, certain jewels and things like that. The Romans actually kept that because they knew what a powerful symbol it was and what a powerful symbol that religious rite was. So they only gave the priestly vestment to the high priest just on that one day, and then they would take it back. Also, multiple Gentile rulers posted troops right there in the Antonia Fortress, right beside the Temple Mount. In case anything happened, the troops would be right there, could go directly into the temple and break up whatever was going on. And of course, during special times, such as the festivals, the Roman procurator would come from Caesarea to Jerusalem. Ostensibly, he would bring extra troops with him to keep an eye on things. This is why Pilate is actually in Jerusalem at the time of Passover when Jesus is crucified. Normally, he would be in Caesarea Maritima, which is up north and on the coast. So they were, again, keeping tabs on what was going on. And of course, the temple hierarchy was made of the Sadducees, who worked very hard to try to tamp down the nationalism that sprouted around the temple and the temple festivals in order to keep the Romans happy. The Sadducees, as you might imagine, as aristocrats, had a lot to lose, and so they wanted to make sure that nothing bad happened to hurt the temple and what they believed in, and, of course, their own power structure. In terms of monotheism, the Gentiles, they sort of understood why a Jew wouldn't go into a Gentile home. We see a reference to that with the story of the centurion in the Gospels. Jesus says, "Hey, I'm going to go to your house." And he says, no, wait a minute. You don't have to do that. Well, again, as we talked about, the Roman homes had household gods, and so that would be sort of like going into another temple. But, for the most part, they didn't like it. Gentiles didn't like it, but they saw it as an ethnic difference, and they kind of not accepted it, but they learned to live with it. Often in their writings, they saw it as what they called misanthropic, meaning that they didn't share in the wider cultural values of friendship and social interaction with other groups. Let me give an interesting story about monotheism and the interaction with Hellenistic Judaism. So there was an Alexandrian pogrom in 33 CE. So we're talking about violence between Gentiles and Jews in Alexandria. And what the Gentiles did is they went into the synagogues and put busts of the emperor in them. Now, this created, of course, somewhat of a problem for the Alexandrian Jews, because if they were going to remove the bust of the emperor, well, that was a sign of insult to the emperor himself, to say, we don't want you here. But at the same time, they couldn't just leave the bust in there, in the synagogue, because that would make the synagogue unclean. Now, unfortunately, the writer doesn't tell us how exactly they fixed this problem, but it is a great illustration of sort of this monotheism being played out in the larger Gentile world. One of the other major signifiers of Jewish identity was marriage. Of course, Old Testament marriage was overseen at the clan level, and the priorities in making marriage at that level were to strengthen the clan politically, religiously, militarily, and to allow and ensure that you keep your resources within the clan. You wouldn't necessarily go marry just whoever you want, because then if the male died, which happened quite often, because the men were usually much older than the women in marriage, then all of the property would go to the woman who, or at least to her father, I should say, who might be of another clan, and then you've lost all of that wealth and property and things like that. So you want to keep those resources within the clan. So we see in the Old Testament that there is a tradition of endogamy within the clan. Jacob goes back to his own people to find a wife. He actually finds two. And then you have Esau, who is condemned in Torah for his choice of local women as wives. Now, there were exceptions to this. Not everyone, of course, could send sons back to the homeland for a wife. And we do show that multiple foreign women became a celebrated part of Israel. For example, Rahab the prostitute. We have a book on Ruth and how she comes back to the land of Israel and gets grafted in to the covenant people. So some of the ethnic lines in the Old Testament are a little bit more blurred than what we see in the Hellenistic period, reflected in Ezra and in what we studied in last week's podcast. So why does marriage become such an important thing in the Hellenistic period? Well, first of all, it gained importance for several reasons. There were ethnic concerns as a minority living within other lands. The covenant people must continue to be who they are and not lose their ethnic identity by mixing with other races. And so marriage becomes another way to differentiate and protect Hellenistic Judaism's identity. And that's what you see in the reforms of Ezra, which pushed endogamy as an important cultural value. Secondly, religious concerns with marriage were to protect against idol worship. You see that in several passages in the Old Testament. In Deuteronomy 7, it says marrying outside will lead to worshiping with other gods. And Leviticus 18, you know, talks about don't give your children to Molech, the fire god. And the idea seems to be if you marry a Gentile, these things could happen. Ezra, for his point, does see marriage as a religious right. He sees it along priestly lines, sort of a way to cleanse the Jewish nation. In terms of the daily life, you know, there were certain pressures that they had to react to. It was tempting for impoverished exiles living other places in the wider world to try to gain social status through marriage with non-Jewish women. Of course, if you're in the upper class, you might prioritize political connections over religious fidelity. So the question comes down to, how Jewish do you really want to be? Of course, if you're a slave, do you even have a choice? Because slaves mostly would have their partners chosen for them by their owner. But we do see in the intertestamental period, many writers, Josephus, Philo, the Book of Jubilees, they all decry intermarriage. So, you know, for the Gentile views on marriage, you know, it'd be a little bit out of our scope to really go in deep on the views of marriage in the intertestamental period. But I'll just say these three things. Gentile writers, for their part, had lots of different views on marriage, the home, and women's place in society, especially in the first century. But it didn't seem to think of ethnicity was really much for them. Of greater interest to them was the structure of society and marriage's place in supporting it, the roles of each sex, the interplay of social standing between marriage partners, and even how many children each couple would bear. And so these are the concerns that kind of bleed over into the New Testament in Paul's letters with his instructions about how wives and husbands are supposed to treat each other and relate to God. He's working out of that social background, if you will. So these are some of the major defining features of Hellenistic Judaism during the intertestamental period. Now let's talk a little bit about how these cultural effects played in the first century in the New Testament. And the first major thing to look at is the question, who are the true children of Abraham? Obviously, with the Christian church and the work of Jesus on the cross, you have instituted what the New Testament presents as the true covenant people of God, being those who worship Jesus the Christ. So, who makes up this covenant people of God, and what is their relationship to Hellenistic Judaism, the Judaism of the Old Testament and the monarchy period? How do those relate? We've already talked a little bit about some of the views of Gentiles and things like that, but I want to pull out the New Testament message specifically. And really what we see are multiple points. For example, Matthew's message is that the covenant people are those who recognize Jesus for who he is and reject the ethnic nationalism of Judaism. Luke's message in his gospel and Acts is one of wide multi-ethnic identity. And that's not surprising since Luke was a Gentile himself, that he would see the larger Gentile world as being included within Jesus' original gospel. In the Gospel of John, we see a debate about being Abraham's children between Jesus and the Pharisees. You know, the Pharisees objected to Jesus' teaching, and Jesus' response in 8:44 is, "Well, your father is the devil." So in John, you have this picture that being a child of Abraham is based on beliefs about Jesus. Again, I think what you see in the Gospels and that they all have in common is the focus of the covenant people is Jesus. In Paul's view, of course, this was a huge question. Paul, of course, being himself a Pharisee originally, going out to the larger Gentile world with his missionaries, journeys and such, you know, this is a big question that we see in his writings. I mean, even today we debate how Paul fits within the first century. you know, we have this thing in scholarship called the New Perspective on Paul from the scholar E.P. Sanders. We have something called the Apocalyptic Paul that you see with Dr. John M. Barclay. So even today, there's disagreement about what is the relationship between Paul and Judaism and the New Testament church. You know, Paul says several things. In Romans 3, he said God is over both the Jew and the Gentile, and the law has a value in that it demonstrated the need for Christ. In Romans 4, he sees that the circumcised and the uncircumcised are the children of Abraham. The Old Testament promises to Abraham of land and descendants are not just specific to, you know, Judea, to the actual promised land. Paul says those have been universalized in a certain sense to the whole world through Jesus. In Galatians 3, of course, the famous passage about there's no difference between races, slave or free, male or female. And then in Ephesians 2, you have this picture of the blood of Christ bringing the uncircumcised into the covenant, that the circumcised and the circumcised through Jesus become one, the bodies become one. And I mean, even today, we have this debate about the relationship between the church and Judaism. So based on Romans 11, should we understand Jews as quote-unquote wayward cousins who will be brought back into the fold? Before 1960, the dispensationalist perspective was that there was actually a different salvation for ethnic Jews than the church. That has largely been discounted now. So if you hear anyone say that, that's been rejected. You can't have two salvations. Jesus is the way. So then we have the question, is the church now the recipient of the spiritualized promises of Abraham? So is it sort of a replacement idea? Does the church step in now in place of the Jewish believers? And of course, the early church had to figure out how to express this new religious identity in non-ethnic terms. So what does this mean to us? Well, I think first it means we need to shift our lens from salvation being about this group or that group. You know, this whole thing about, oh, well, we need to only witness to certain groups, that does not fit within the gospel message. And I think, secondly, we have to say, clearly, there is no special status, no special salvation for any group. Everyone comes in by the grace and the work of Christ. The second question for the first century caused by these cultural issues was, are Judaism and Christianity open or closed to outsiders? One of the cultural questions being debated in the first century is what it means to be an open culture that accepts other people, other groups, other ethnos. So the Jewish ethnicity generally was seen, especially by the Romans, as one that is closed to outsiders. You have to convert, you have to accept certain rights over others, you have to reject your previous ethnic identity. Josephus, who is Jewish, responds to this in his book Against Appian. He responds to the critics of Judaism who have written things such as, you know, that there is a golden donkey's head in the temple. And so what he does is he defends the idea that Judaism is not misanthropic, but rather that it builds up the character seen in high esteem in the Roman world. So, again, virtue, like we talked about, love for humanity, etc. And so we see this in Against Appian. And he says, just quickly, he says that, but chiefly out of ill will to us, while they calumniate Moses as an imposter and a deceiver, and pretend that our laws teach us wickedness, but nothing that is virtuous. I have a mind to discourse briefly, according to my ability, about our whole constitution of government, and about the particular branches of it. For I suppose it will thence become evident that the laws we have given us are disposed after the best manner for the advancement of piety, for mutual communion with one another, for a general love of mankind, as also for justice, and for sustaining labors with fortitude, and for a contempt of death. And I beg of those that shall peruse this writing of mine to read it without partiality, for it is not my purpose to write an encomium upon ourselves, but I shall esteem this as a most just apology for us, and taken from those our laws according to which we lead our lives against the many and the lying objections that have been made against us. So he is responding against this. And we also see this in his portrayal of Jewish forefathers in his Jewish antiquities. He is, in this book, going through and presenting Jewish history in Roman terms. So Jewish leaders reflect the Roman ideals of virtue, a cosmopolitan outlook. You know, let me give you an example with David. So David's on his deathbed. He gives instructions to Solomon in 1 Kings 2. He tells him to follow the Mosaic law to protect the dynasty, reminds him to have mercy on certain tribes, and he tells Solomon to go kill certain people. Well, this is related by Josephus in Book 7. He says that David is an excellent man, possessing every virtue, brave. He's the, quote, first to rush into danger, and he does not command his soldiers like a master. So, again, he's trying to argue against the Roman idea that Judaism was misanthropic. And we also see this same sort of discussion of whether Christianity and Judaism are open or closed underlying the book of Luke Acts, with its depiction of Jesus and the disciples as freely welcoming Gentiles into the church. So, you know, this picture of the kingdom of God that you see in Luke kind of subverts this national idea of the restoration of Israel. And we'll talk more about what that means in our next podcast. So Jesus in Nazareth, in the synagogue in Luke 4, stands up and announces that he is the anointed one. But yet, they want to throw him off a cliff, not because of his proclamation of his ministry in the year of Jubilees. They wanted to do it because he referenced that he was going to go to the Gentiles with this message of the kingdom of God. Parables also play on this theme. So in parables, the kingdom of God makes use of these unexpected items or people that are considered unclean, like the Gentiles. In the parable of the mustard seed, you have the kingdom of God is like the tree from an unclean weed. That's what mustard was, according to the law. And it kind of satirizes this picture of the cedar of Lebanon, which was an image of Jewish identity. So Christianity coming out of Judaism and flourishing in the synagogues early on in the movement had to answer this cultural question of response to misanthropy. And Christians rejected this idea that they were not open to all others because they said you don't have to identify with a new ethnos. You can stay a Roman and be a Christian. And that was seen as dangerous to the Romans because it was outside of their normal categories of how they saw ethnicity. So what does this mean to us? Well, I think this question of are we open or closed to outsiders raises how we see conversion and faith in our time. Do we believe, like the Romans, that a new believer needs to reject all of their formal relationships, ideas, and identities? Or do we see those as new contexts to take the gospel to, for those people to bridge their new faith with their former friends? And, you know, I'll say this, it's not a black and white answer, as it wasn't for first century believers. But it comes down to, do we bring people into our holy huddle, or do we go out to the streets? So this question really leads us to our final impact on the New Testament. Must Gentile Christians also follow Jewish ethnic customs? So with the Jewish identity being tied up in the previous discussed factors, the question inevitably arose in the early church, do Gentiles need to be treated along the lines of Jewish proselytes and take on Jewish customs? And we see several different things going on in the New Testament. Peter is actually criticized for eating at a Gentile house in Acts 10 and 11. And this really suggests that the ideal of ethnic separation and the concern for ethnic purity still was alive and well in the Christian church in Jerusalem. Paul, of course, appeals to the Jerusalem Council on this question in Acts 15. So there were several different groups that were represented here. There was a group that were also Pharisees. They're sort of Pharisaical Christians, if you will. And they said Gentiles should be circumcised and follow the law. Paul, for his point, disagreed and points to the seal of the Holy Spirit on the Gentile believers. And James suggests the following requirements. He says, all we ask is that they abstain from food polluted by idols, abstain from sexual immorality, and abstain from meat of strangled animals and blood. Paul generally follows this pattern, with the exceptions of the food related to idols. You know, he says in 1 Corinthians 8 that those who can't eat food sacrificed to idols have a weak and defiled conscience. But he defers to them for the sake of grace. He also gives instructions on how to handle awkward social situations, sort of like we talked about earlier. If you go to someone's house and they give you something that maybe isn't right for you to eat, how do you deal with that? Yet we still see disputes with Peter showing up at Antioch over forcing Gentiles to follow Jewish food customs. That's in Galatians 2. We see Paul continuing to go after those who insist on Gentile circumcision. He calls them dogs and mutilators of the flesh in Philippians 3. And of course, later in his life, Paul is accused by opponents of teaching Jews not to follow the law. You see that in Acts 21. So Paul demonstrates fealty to the law as a Jewish believer by going through the purity rites in the temple. And that's when an uproar was caused that led to his arrest and imprisonment and eventually his execution. So, and of course, you know, Paul did have Timothy circumcised because he was half Jewish. Now, this question really became moot late in the first century because Christians separated from the synagogue communities. So there was this social separation. Maybe they were kicked out. We're not exactly sure. The apostles themselves, of course, die, and the church becomes more Gentile in its leadership. There was a poll tax, as I mentioned before, put on Jews by the Romans. And so Gentile Christians were being treated differently from Jewish, Hellenistic Jews. And so because of that, there was also some social separation. And then, of course, the ultimate thing is the Jewish revolt in 70 CE. Christians really distanced themselves from that Jewish nationalism so as to not be seen as collaborators. So what does this question mean to us today? Well, you know, today no one really argues that we should keep Torah, or, as they called it, the customs of the fathers. But I think it's a good question to ask, have we put other things in their place? It's definitely a part of our evangelical heritage that I claim, at least as my own, that we do put things sometimes in the place, or at least we have in the past. I went to Wheaton College. When I went there, we had something called the Statement of Responsibilities, a.k.a. the Pledge, and it had certain things on it, such as you don't drink. It also said that we were not supposed to dance. So there were no official Wheaton dances, I guess you'd say, except for square dancing. That was the one form of dancing that was allowed, as anachronistically as that seems. So, you know, you get this, sometimes you get this sense of, in the evangelical tradition, that we don't do that. And one of the problems with it is that we really risk anachronism. Cultural issues change. And what we really need to focus on is the message of the gospel, not necessarily cultural barriers that we might see as important now, but in 30 years might not be such a major issue. So I think the question for us is, can we follow what Paul expresses? Freedom with responsibility. So we've come to the end of our time together on this podcast, and I just want to talk a little bit about our takeaways. We've talked today about Hellenism forcing the Jewish community of the intertestamental period to further define what makes up Jewish identity. Jewish cultural actions serve to highlight distinctions from the larger Gentile world. And these distinctive habits help the Jewish community understand who was in and who was outside of the community. Now, there were many disagreements on the best way to apply these markers and many interpretations of the markers themselves. And these issues were confronted by the Christian community as well, as seen in the New Testament writers. But most became moot over time as the Christian community separated from the Jewish community and the cultural values changed. Thanks for joining me today. We'll continue next time with our final two podcasts. I appreciate you listening, and I wish you grace and peace through Jesus Christ. Thank you.